from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, clashes in Kiev yesterday left at least 25 people dead as police set fire to the city's main protest camp. Demonstrations began in November when President Viktor Yanukovych rejected an economic deal with the European Union to maintain stronger ties with Russia. We'll discuss the latest crisis and talk about the road ahead for Ukraine, a nation of 46 million, formerly the second largest republic in the Soviet Union. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday turned violent and lethal in Kiev as months of protests in the former Soviet Republic of Ukraine erupted into the deadliest day yet as riot police moved against protesters who were behind barriers throughout Independence Square. The protests had begun peacefully last November against a decision by Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych to turn down a trade deal with Europe and tilt toward Russia. Now there are at least 25 dead and hundreds injured. In this opening Forum Hour, we want to turn our attention once again to the ongoing crisis and violence in Ukraine. We want to bring first into discussion here Helmut Trumm, who is in Ukraine, in Kiev, in fact. He's an editor with the Eastern European Bloomberg News, and he joins us right on the scene there in Kiev. And welcome, Helmut Trumm. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks.
Let me begin by just asking you about what we're seeing now. I mean, what the present situation is. Yesterday, things were all on fire, and now has the fire pretty much gone down?
No, what we are watching right now is the people are still on Independence Square. In fact, it seems like people have flooded back onto the square during the day. Protesters have tried to refortify the barricades. They brought in fresh supplies. You could watch people on the streets building Molotov cocktails, bringing in food supplies, supplies for the fires that they have erected in defense against the security forces. At the moment, the situation on the square seems very tense but stable. There's no signs, at least for the moment, that the security forces would move to dissolve the protest, but that could change any minute.
Well, the government has announced an anti-terrorist campaign, which sounds rather ominous. Is there any sense from your perspective of whether this was I mean, the police are blaming the protesters, the protesters are blaming the police about how the violence began yesterday, or who was really more culpable?
Well, it's really hard to tell. I mean, it really seems to me that Yanukovych finally has decided to draw a line in the sand. And when protests became violent yesterday, it seems like a couple of police officers got killed, and some of the demonstrators are equipped with firearms, he basically drew a line in the sand and decided, okay, that's it. I have to do something about this. And it does seem that signs of a martial law in Ukraine are emerging, because Yanukovych has said he will grant sweeping powers to the army and police force, which means they can detain people. They can search offices, private apartments, and in fact shoot at people.
It's also been reported that police were using live ammunition and grenades that are wrapped with tape with nails in them and stones in them to make them more dangerous. On the other hand, it's been reported that the protesters are throwing rocks at police and, as you said, shooting at them as well. I mean, are we possibly, since the West, as a Western province, has declared an independence, are we on the verge of a civil war?
I think there's definitely a risk. I think what is worrying is that the European Union seems to have lost all communication lines with Yanukovych. And this is why now a delegation of foreign ministers, that's the Polish foreign minister Sikorski, his colleague from Germany, Steinmeier, and Fabius from France, they are flying in tonight and tomorrow morning, and they claim they have a meeting scheduled now with Yanukovych to try and reestablish communication.
We're talking with Helmut Tromm, who is with us from Kiev. He's editor of Eastern European Bloomberg News, currently reporting from Kiev for Bloomberg News. And I'm wondering, Helmut Tromm, at this point, the city that was within a city, there were thousands of protesters who had built, according to reports, their own economy, and they had a parliament, they had a cathedral, they even had a library. What is the status of that city within a city at this point?
Well, it is quite bizarre. Like, for instance, our office is very, very close to Independence Square. It's less than a mile away, I would estimate. And when you look out onto the street here, you can't see anything. But then, as I said, like a mile down the road, there are fire burning. People are digging up the street, collecting stones. There are these barricades. So there, it's really close to anarchy. It's quite worrying.
Worrying to the degree that we could see, like I had indicated earlier, something akin to an insurrection?
Well, I definitely think so, yes. The police, they have taken measures. They are now checking cars coming into Kiev. And with these new powers that Yanukovych has granted to the security forces, including army forces, I think things could really get ugly. What is worrying is that a lot of the demonstrators seem to be equipped with handguns as well, with hunting rifles. There's an estimate that around 1.5 million people in Ukraine have legal possession of firearms, and a lot more people illegally possess firearms. And we've heard people on the stage on Independence Square calling on people to bring their firearms onto the square.
So there's been a definite shift, an escalation from yesterday in terms of violence on both sides.
Yes, definitely. When you talk to people on the square, they say this is a one-way street for us. Either we win this battle here on Independence Square, or it's the end.
Helmut Tromm, again with us from Kiev. He's editor of Eastern European's Bloomberg News. And thank you so much for joining us on Forum.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Let me tell you who else is joining us to assess what's going on in Ukraine. Alexander Model is a professor of political science at Rutgers in Newark. He's a specialist on Ukraine and Russia and joins us this morning from New York City. Welcome, Professor Model.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Also good to have Sari Plokhi with us. And Sari Plokhi is director of Ukrainian Research Institute, professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. He joins us this morning from outside of Boston in Arlington, Massachusetts. And good to have you with us as well. Good morning.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let me begin, Alexander Model, with you, if I may. And we should mention that just yesterday, or excuse me, on Monday, there was an amnesty for anti-government protesters. Ironically, about 234 were released. But you've talked about Yanukovych as essentially being, well, a gangster, a criminal thug.
Well, he is. Whether it's a question of his actual personal background, remember, this is a guy who spent two terms in jail as a teenager, one for attempted rape, the other was for theft. During that period, he was recruited, presumably by the KGB, and that then led to his career thereafter. So there's lots of evidence for that. But more fundamentally, he's a product of a peculiar kind of economic, political, social mindset in this industrial rust belt called the Donbass. That used to be considered the forefront of the communist system and now has essentially become something like an economic black hole. But within this region, people like him and the party he represents, the Party of Regions, have formed a symbiotic relationship with organized crime and the tycoons. They're known as oligarchs. So you have this very repressive system, which, upon closer inspection, really resembles the mafia. or Al Capone, if you like. I mean, people often refer to Yanukovych as a gangster and to his supporters within the Party of Regions as gangsters, and they mean that metaphorically, but it's actually a very accurate depiction of who they are and the way they act.
Well, when you mention regions, the East is largely pro-Russian, and in many people's minds there seems to be almost a division between Eastern and Western, or Eastern and Southern against Western. There are those in the West who are seeking transformation because they see Poland across the border. And how much of that divide really are we talking about here in the present crisis?
Look, I mean, on the one hand, if you go to the far west of Ukraine, say the city of Lviv, right, it is obviously very different from the far east of Ukraine, say the city of Luhansk. There's no question about that. But what we tend to forget in talking about these east-west divisions is two things. One is that there is a gradation from east to west and from west to east and north-south. So there is no one obvious dividing line. It's not like you can draw a line down the Dnieper or Dnipro River, which divides the country, and say everybody in this side is this and everybody in that side is the opposite. That's just not true. And the other thing we tend to forget is that, you know, I, for one, don't know of a single country in the world, except perhaps for Japan, which doesn't have serious regional, ethnic, and other kinds of divisions. That kind of diversity is pretty much normal for contemporary states. The problem for Ukraine, it's not the diversity per se. It's not the fact that some people, you know, people disagree fundamentally on issues. It's that this Donbas region, the region which Yanukovych controls, I mean, it's the southeast of Ukraine, is essentially ruled by this gangster organization, which eventually succeeded in establishing control of Kiev, and over the last 3 years has been trying to establish control over the rest of Ukraine. And it's that, it's this thuggish criminal organization, which is the problem, and it's, of course, also the main reason for the current unrest. I mean, people are upset about the fact that Yanukovych didn't sign the association agreement, but that was just the straw that broke the camel's back. The bottom line was that they had been upset by the fact that his regime had systematically plundered the country, robbed it of all of its democratic institutions and freedoms, and treated the people with complete disdain. One of the common themes in all the demonstrations over the last 3 years is that Ukrainians should be treated as human beings. In that sense, these demonstrations, which are a continuation of those that have been taking place for 3 years, are really, really very, very similar to what was taking place in the civil rights movement. You recall the demonstrators in Birmingham back in the early 1950s used to carry signs saying, "I am a man." And that, I think, is really at the core of what's driving these people. They want to be considered human beings and not, well, cattle, which is what the Party of Regents and Yanukovych have been treating them as.
Alexander Motyl, again, is professor of political science at Rutgers and a specialist on Ukraine and Russia. And Sergei Plahy is director of the Ukrainian Research Institute, professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. And Professor Plahy, I'm struck by the fact that, and many people are, about the timing of this. A lot of what exploded on Tuesday came right after, essentially, Russia agreed to give $2 billion more to Ukraine. Now, this was essentially part of a deal for cheaper gas and a $15 billion package of government bonds. The real question is, I suppose, in many people's minds, how much is Russia behind the scenes here, particularly Putin?
Well, we know a close advisor of Mr. Putin stated publicly a few days ago that a violent crackdown on the protesters, that was the only way to solve the crisis in Ukraine. And what we see now, soon after this additional $2 billion being delivered, that exactly that is happening. And this is happening after the weekend and the preceding few days that witnessed actually many, many very, or gave very positive signs in terms of many protesters were released. So hopefully the whole situation was moving towards some kind of a compromise. But what happened yesterday and Tuesday was that the government refused to register the bill proposed by opposition to go back to the old constitution
That was, forgive me, that was a parliament vote that's set up for this week, in fact.
Well, actually, that's what. This is what was happening yesterday in the morning.
I mean, essentially, it was to amend the constitution, form a new cabinet, and take away presidential power. So, what you're saying is, on procedural grounds, I believe the government essentially took it away.
Well, actually, the government, according to the law, they couldn't actually say no to the registration of a bill, and they did that. This speculation, and also, I guess it's a grounded it's an assessment, is that they didn't have enough votes in the parliament. And what government is doing today is announcing this anti-terrorist action, and again for the same reason, because they don't have enough votes to introduce state of emergency.
So this is intensifying the situation. And let me ask you also about where the EU and where the United States comes into this. Secretary of State Kerry said in Paris that sanctions were being considered, and senior administration officials told CNN that a final decision could come later in the day today, and the EU is meeting tomorrow. But I expect Yanukovych expects sanctions, doesn't he?
Well, my understanding is that Radoslav Sikorski, the foreign minister of Poland, and other European foreign ministers who are coming to Kyiv are supposed to spell out to Yanukovych and people around him what specifically those sanctions will be and who will be affected by them. My understanding is that Yanukovych is psychologically at least prepared for that kind of sanctions. I am not sure about the people around him, and certainly I'm not sure about the tycoons and Ukrainian oligarchs, because they will have they stand to lose the most from that kind of sanctions, and his government really depends on the support of Ukrainian oligarchs. So while Yanukovych probably is prepared, I'm not sure that people around him are in a position to ignore that kind of sanction.
Well, they could bring suasion to him, clearly. Can you comment also on the fact there's supposed to be a naming of a new, essentially, I believe, a PR in a day? Isn't there supposed to be some kind of appointment made in Ukraine?
Again, the plans were that yesterday the ruling party was supposed to propose the prime minister, and they postponed doing that, and postponed apparently for a few days. They said that a new prime minister will be presented to the parliament during this week. But now it is, given what is happening, it is also very clear why they didn't that when they promised to do that, and that means yesterday.
Serhii Plahy again directs the Ukrainian Research Institute. We want to also bring into this discussion Roman Sportko, who is an organizer of Euro Made in San Francisco and who is in Los Angeles this morning. And Roman Sportko, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Yeah, I should mention that your group actually formed a show solidarity with participants in Ukraine with the protesters. And at this point, you're in solidarity with them. What does that mean? I mean, how much can you give them support and how much can they grow from your support?
Yeah, so we are the group of people, mostly the Ukrainians of America and American citizens with Ukrainian background. And we are doing several things. We are moving towards several directions. First of all, we are throwing demonstrations all over the U.S. in order to bring attention to the things that are happening now back in Ukraine. This Saturday, we're throwing demonstration in San Francisco near City Hall at 1 p.m. Other than that, the demonstration has been thrown in New York City, Washington, and other cities all over the U.S. Other than that, we are providing financial support to the rebels back in Kyiv. We are supplying medications, armor. We are doing informational support for them. Other than that, we're supporting the people via social networks. We're fighting against the propaganda, which is spread not only via TV and newspapers, but all over the internet. We have social networks as well, from mostly like from Russian-related sources. So that are the main directions we are working towards.
Well, I just wanted to get you on record with that. And you, again, when is your protest going to be for people who want to attend here in San Francisco?
It's going to be true on Saturday, 1 p.m. near the City Hall. So we're going to be throwing the protests, attracting attention of the U.S. representatives. We're probably going to have the direct connection with Maidan. We're going to be translating everything to Maidan and vice versa. So everybody who wants to support the the rebels back in Kyiv, the people of Ukraine, will be glad to see you all in San Francisco Saturday 1 p.m. at City Hall.
All right, Roman Shvortko, thank you for joining us. Roman Shvortko, again, is an organizer for Euromaidan, in San Francisco. And let me go back to Alexander Model, who's with us this morning from New York City, a professor of political science at Rutgers and a specialist on Ukraine and Russia. Some have said, Professor Model, that a lot of this it really has to do with more Russia and the United States, Ukraine being a sort of surrogate for Putin, and that intervention by Russia is possible because, so it's argued by Stephen Cohen, I believe, among others, what's at stake is NATO and the possible involvement of Ukraine in NATO.
Good Lord. Let me be very blunt, but virtually everything Stephen Cohen has said about Ukraine is complete and utter nonsense. Ukraine's chances of getting into NATO are extremely slim, if existent at all, point one. Point two, anybody who knows NATO knows that it's a paper tiger, to use Mao Zedong's terminology. And the Russians, who have their spies in Brussels galore, know this extremely well. All of this is just essentially a smokescreen for what is really going on. Why is Russia so interested in Ukraine? It's interested in Ukraine for the same reasons that it's interested in ingathering, or as they put it, reintegrating the various non-Russian, the former non-Russian republics of the Soviet Union. This has been part and parcel of Vladimir Putin's agenda from day one.
Isn't it Russian nationalism redux?
It's a combination of nationalism, but more importantly, it's he's constructed a regime that is fundamentally anti-democratic, it's authoritarian, it's corrupt, and his claim to fame, his ability to maintain his popularity to a very large degree rests on his ability to make a persuasive case for restoring Russia's place in the sun. Remember, in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia lost an empire and it lost superpower status virtually overnight. This is almost unprecedented in world history.
Professor Model, forgive me, but we're coming up on a break, and the break stops for no one. It's a hard break. And I want to give out the phone number because I want to invite listeners to join this conversation. Your thoughts about the violence growing in the Ukraine or any questions you might have, you can join us now. Toll free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Clashes in Kyiv yesterday left at least 18 people. Well, now it's 25, in fact, at latest count, dead as police set fire to the city's main protest camp and demonstrations that began in November when President Viktor Yanukovych rejected an economic deal with the European Union to maintain stronger ties with Russia have moved to what may be an insurrection or a civil war, as we've heard earlier from Helmut Tromm, who joined us from Kyiv. We're talking also with Professor Alexander Model from Rutgers and Professor Zerhi Plati from, he's director of Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard. And we did speak with Roman Shvortko, too, who is an organizer for Euromaidan. We want to bring you into this discussion, and if you do have questions or comments about Kyiv or responses to what's going on there, we want to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. Before I go to calls and emails, I want to go to Stephen Pfeiffer, who is presently senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and he joins us from the nation's capital. Stephen Pfeiffer, good to have you with us.
Glad to join you.
I guess my initial question for you, and I know this has come up to you and your attention before, is just how much the United States is involved in this. There have been charges by Sergei Glazyev that we're providing weapons, we're financing the rebels. He's an aide to Vladimir Putin. Is there any evidence of that?
There's no evidence, and those charges, frankly, are nonsense. It fits into a narrative that the Kremlin is trying to portray, which is that what is going on in Ukraine is manipulated by Westerners, the Americans, the Europeans. And it's really, in a way, condescending towards Ukrainians who are out there protesting because, you know, they're tired of the corruption, they're tired of the authoritarian streak they've seen in the government, and they want to see their country move closer to Europe.
And what about the concern over Russian intervention? There is anxiety about that. Is it justified?
I think the Russians certainly are involved. We don't know the conversations that have taken place, and there have been a number of conversations between Vladimir Putin and the Ukrainian President, Viktor Yanukovych. But I think it would be a good guess to assume that the Russians have been encouraging Mr. Yanukovych to do the crackdown that we've unfortunately seen over the last day and a half.
Russia is blaming the West, though. They're blaming the EU and the U.S. They've even used the word my Russian isn't as good as it used to be, but a kind of the word that means conniving together or something along those lines. And the truth of the matter is that the United States has certainly strong interests in backing Ukraine and backing the rebels in Ukraine.
Well, I think the U.S. interest here is one, trying to find a peaceful settlement out of the crisis. I mean, everything that I've seen is that the focus of U.S. efforts, and I think the European Union as well, has been to try to encourage a political dialogue between Yanukovych on the one hand and the opposition leaders that might define a peaceful path out of that crisis. And that's one of the big tragedies of yesterday is those kind of actions that we saw last night and which continue today are making finding that kind of peaceful settlement very, very difficult.
Well, the White House is floating ideas of sanctions. I wonder what your take is on that. And there's also been talk about bringing Yanukovych to the International Criminal Court.
Well, I think it is time for the United States and the European Union to apply targeted visa and financial sanctions with two goals. One goal would be to make clear to Ukrainians who engage in use of force that they will be held responsible, but also to target the inner circle around Yanukovych, that group of oligarchs, to make them understand that unless they're part of the solution, unless they're pushing Yanukovych to find a solution, they too might be liable to prohibitions on travel to the West and also may lose their ability to bank in the West. I think that would hurt them, and that might encourage them to use their influence with Yanukovych to adopt a course different from what we now see.
Again, Stephen Pfeiffer is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Let me bring in our callers, and we begin, Frank, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. While I was on hold, I think Mr. Pfeiffer has at least answered part of my question, which is, given that both Putin and Yanukovych are eminently willing to use force against the one his own people, and in Putin's case, anybody. Why is it that the European Union and American efforts are just so much hand wringing? That the level of leverage that we have and the time frame over which it applies is going to be so much slower than the crushing of the dissidents. That it's going to be futile. Does Mr. Pfeiffer or anybody else have an opinion on that?
Let me go to you on this, Steve Pfeiffer.
Well, 2 points. I mean, first of all, I wish that the United States and particularly the European Union had moved to apply sanctions earlier. The United States did announce some limited sanctions about 3 weeks ago. The European Union has yet to take that step. And I worry that we're passing the time when those sanctions could have maximum impact. But I think the second point that we have to recognize, well, is that it's an uneven struggle if you're looking at the Russia on the one hand and the United States and Europe on the other. Is the Russians are prepared to do more. They care more about losing Ukraine than I think Europe cares about gaining Ukraine. So Putin was prepared to offer $15 billion in credits in December. The West was not prepared to get into that kind of bidding war. So there is this imbalance in the playing fields here that is going to make it, I think, more complicated. But I think we have to remember that while Russia, the United States, and Europe can have some influence, you know, this is a crisis that has to be worked out first and foremost by the Ukrainians themselves.
Well, let me go back, to Serhiy Plohy, again, who directs Ukrainian Research Institute and is professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. Sanctions would mean travel bans, and it would also probably mean asset freezes, which, again, brings into play here these powerful oligarchs. I mean, how much power do they really have to press Yanukovych?
Well, I think over the last couple of years...
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I'll go back to you on this, Stephen Pfeiffer, but I want to go first to Serhiy Plohy.
They control powerful factions within the coalition created by the ruling party. One of the richest person in Ukraine, actually, is Renat Akhmetov, and there is a couple of dozens of deputies, apparently, that he has influence over. Then Serhiy Tyhypko and Firtash and others. And my understanding is that it is the threat of the sanctions that caused cracks within that coalition, and that is why the government now doesn't go to the parliament to get approval for the state of emergency or other actions that they undertake. Again, if the sanctions become really real and something that will threaten their businesses, I am pretty sure that they will redouble their efforts to influence Yanukovych. One more thing that they have, another leverage, is the control of the media. And it looks like that at this point, both Pinchuk, another oligarch, and Akhmetov, they issued statements calling for violence to stop, but really did nothing in terms of their influence over media to basically either support protests or at least support the peaceful solution.
Stephen Pfeiffer, let's get you in on this.
No, I would agree completely with the press. I think the point of sanctions is to begin to widen those fissures within that inner circle around Yanukovych. Somebody like Mr. Akhmetov has an apartment in London that reportedly cost 80 million pounds. If all of a sudden he begins to see a risk that he can't travel there to go to that apartment, I think he's going to become unhappy. And that makes him either push and use the influence that he has with Yanukovych to get Yanukovych to end the violence and seek a peaceful solution, or it encourages Akhmetov to pull away from Yanukovych, which undermines his support.
Here's a caller from Raleigh, North Carolina. Doug, you're on with us on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. Not to excuse Russia or the leadership in Ukraine, but, you know, Russia's lost tens of millions of people from invasions from Europe in the last century. And how much do your guests think this informs Russia's desire to always have a buffer between themselves and, Europe?
Now, let me go to you on this, Alexander Model.
Well, there are two points. Point number one is during World Wars One and Two, the primary losses, and specifically in World War Two, the primary losses suffered by the Soviet Union were, by the way, amongst Ukrainians and Belarusians. Russian losses were actually very minimal. And last but not least, let's not forget the Jewish population, which suffered terribly. So it's not Russians fearful of Russian deaths. It's possibly Russians fearful of Belarusian, Ukrainian, and Jewish deaths. The more important point is, do you seriously think of the European Union as a strategic military threat to anybody? And I don't think anybody in the world thinks that's the case. I mean, the European Union is cutting back on its individual armies, not terribly interested in taking part in NATO. This is not a player geopolitically on the world arena and poses absolutely no threat whatsoever. And then there's the point of NATO. As I said, NATO is an organization that is in complete disarray. It's looking for an identity. It's not sure what it is. It's not sure what it's about. To think that NATO poses a threat to Russia is, again, to my mind, somewhat unrealistic.
Stephen Pfeiffer, would you agree with that? Because Stephen Cohen and others have brought NATO into this whole equation in a major way.
Yeah, well, first of all, I wouldn't discount the number of Russians who died in World War II. It was a tragedy for Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians alike. But no, I think since 2008, 2009, it's been pretty clear that the Ukrainian population does not support moving towards membership in NATO. But there is strong support, I think, within Ukraine for a deeper relationship with the European Union. And many Ukrainians, and I think even Yanukovych, in a way wanted to be able to do both, is draw closer to Europe, but still have a constructive relationship with Russia. But it's been the Russians who've tried to create this either-or situation and saying, you know, no, if you're going to go and do an association agreement with the European Union and draw closer to Europe, then there will be penalties. There will be financial sanctions. There will be trade sanctions, which they applied to demonstrate that back in the summer. So that either-or choice has been forced upon the Ukrainians by Moscow.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's Neil. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Good morning. I'll try to make this quick. We hear a lot about the opposition and the protesters as if it's one group. Maybe your panel can talk about the different groups within the quote-unquote opposition and the quote-unquote protesters. And in particular, I've heard, but I don't know how accurate it is, to describe some of the instigators in the protesters as skinheads, proto-fascists, ultra-nationalists. And a broad analogy is, for example, in Syria, we support the opposition, but I think the Americans aren't too thrilled about some of the, I'll call them, jihadists in the opposition in Syria. So if your guests could talk about the group or groups that make up the opposition and the protesters, I think that might be helpful.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Neil. And Sari Pleti, certainly... we've heard about this Right Seder group, which sees the buildings, and the Svoboda group, which is a lot more specific, Pacific. Can you break it down for us?
Well, there are three main opposition groups in the parliament, and then also they're the leading force when it comes to what is happening on Maidan. One group is associated with Ukraine's former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, who is imprisoned by the current government, and it is called Fatherland Party, and I would call it maybe a liberal kind of party. Then another group in its influence, probably growing more and more, is led by the world heavyweight champion, whose name is Klitschko.
The boxer.
The boxer, exactly. And again, this would be centrist and liberal as well. And then the third group is Svoboda Party or Freedom Party, which is basically a nationalist party based mostly in Western Ukraine, but also now becoming more and more popular in Kyiv and in Central Ukraine. So these groups working together, and generally the last poll that I saw, what is happening is that the leader, Mr. Klitschko, is gaining in popularity as the result of these events on Maidan. So it's not the Mrs. Tymoshenko's party or the Svoboda Nationalist Party. So I guess what happened in the last 3 months is the appearance of, out of three leaders, one person who is more popular than the rest and is often serves as a spokesman, and this is Mr. Klitschko.
And again, Serhii Plohy is director of the Ukrainian Research Institute and professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. If you'd like to join the program, by the way, in the time remaining, our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, and our website, kqed.org/forum. Looking at some emails here that I'd like to get some response to. I'm sorry, did I hear somebody's voice?
Yes, I was hoping. Can I make a brief comment?
Yes, of course. This is Professor Model.
There was a very interesting academic survey that was conducted about 2-3 weeks ago of the participants in Independence Square, that is to say the demonstrators themselves. Again, academic, objective, neutral. The average age is about 37, 38, 95% male, 5% female, roughly 50% from Western Ukraine, roughly 20-25% from Kyiv and the environs, and roughly 25+% from Southeastern Ukraine. The nationalities that were represented were obviously first and foremost Ukrainian, but you also have significant numbers of Russians, Jews, and Crimean Tatars. I want to emphasize all three of those groups are represented as well. And then in terms of language use, roughly 50 to 55% of the people on the Independence Square speak Ukrainian, and roughly 45% speak Russian.
I want to go to some emails here that really press on the issue of the response of the United States. And Stephen Pfeiffer, let me get your response to these emails. Irina writes, why not start pressing Putin and use sanctions against him? He is deeply involved in Syria, in Ukraine, and the United States has zero leverage against his power. And another listener, Joe, writes, recently John Kerry stated that we stand behind the Ukrainian protesters. Essentially, the same statement was made by the first Bush administration with respect to the Kurds in Iraq, resulting in their uprising and Saddam Hussein gassing their villages. Why does the United States make such statements when we are not prepared to back them up with force? And I guess really both emails speak to the role of the United States in all this, particularly vis-a-vis Russia.
Sure. Well, by the question of force, I assume no one is talking about parachuting the 82nd Airborne into Kyiv. When you actually look at the tools that the United States has to influence this situation, unfortunately, they're quite limited. I believe that sanctions targeted at Ukrainians are likely to have much more impact in resolving this than sanctions at the Russians. Given other complexities in the U.S.-Russia relationship, there's not a lot of leverage that Washington has, I think, to affect Moscow's calculations on this. Whereas I do believe that visa and financial sanctions targeted at the right Ukrainians have the potential to begin to change the game, either by increasing pressure on Yanukovych from some of the people in his own circle, or by having those people leave and perhaps, as one of the other panelists mentioned, take away their votes in the Regions Party in the parliament, which could cause Yanukovych to lose his majority in the parliament.
Let me go actually to one of the professors who's with us, Professor Model or Professor Plutty, on this next email, which expresses some concerns about how Western media is covering the events in Ukraine. And this listener, Paul, writes, number one, the Ukraine is essentially split into a Ukrainian half in the West, which wants to align with Europe, and a Russian half in the East, who wants to align with Russia. In the West, we only hear about the Western half and events in Kyiv. Number two, the media seems to ignore the fact that Yanukovych was elected in apparently fair elections, primarily by support in the East, and treats him like a dictator. Where things stand now is the mob in the streets is dictating government policy, and this sort of defeats the point of the elections. And number three, Western media by default assumes integration with the European Union is good and any dealings with Russia evil, and any concerns about industrial trade with Russia in the eastern half are ignored. Look, I'm not saying Yanukovych is a great leader or make any judgment on anything, except that I think Western coverage on events are very slanted toward the West, and I hope that Forum can attempt to present a more neutral view of a very complex situation with 1,000 years of history behind it. Let me go first to you, Professor Plotty, if I could.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What we have is the majority of Ukrainian population, Russian-speaking, Ukrainian-speaking, Tatar, Crimean Tatar speaking, the majority of Ukrainians support the integration into European Union and certainly supported the signing of the association agreement with EU. That gave boost in popularity to Mr. Yanukovych and the government of Yanukovych. So that's in terms of the beginning of the protests and in terms of the support for the EU integration in the country. When it comes to current divisions, what we see is really mobilized population in support of EU. Those who are against that, we don't see them actually manifesting on the streets. So for the media to report on what is happening there, there are only supporters of the EU that voice their support for that option. The pro-Russian section, again, we see the government organizing them and paying them to come to Kyiv, but there is no self-mobilization or on the same level or comparable level to what we see on the pro-EU side.
Well, I'm looking at an online comment from a listener who says, Ukraine needs better suitors. It's caught in a tug of war between a wife beater in the northeast, Moscow, and an indebted gambler in the west and the EU. Each would make a bad partner. But here's Dan, and let me go to you, Alexander Model, on this, who writes, there's a lot of talk about the Russian hidden agenda and Putin's desire to reassemble the USSR. Unfortunately, The U.S. and EU do not care about Ukraine as an independent country either. Looks like they continue to play the geopolitical chess game of Brzezinski, where Ukraine is an unfortunate pawn. They only want to weaken Russia because in their warped worldview, a weak Russia still means a stronger U.S. and EU. Both sides are at fault. Whether Ukrainians like it or not, they are bound to Russia economically and culturally. EU, U.S., and Russia need to work on this together, but Western leaders continue to burn the bridges with Russia.
Well, I'll have to agree with what the ambassador said. The West, and as well as most Ukrainians, have expressed a desire to have perfectly decent relations with Russia. I mean, again, public opinion surveys show over the last 10, 15 years that 90% of Ukrainians have a very favorable disposition toward Russians and Russia. So the issue of Russia is, in some ways, a false one. The issue is Putin and his insistence that there be a black and white choice. You're either with us or you're against us. The only position that Ukraine can logically assume is to have good relations with both East and West. What's wrong with that? And in principle, that should be appealing to Putin as well. Alas, precisely because of his own political agenda, which relates to this need to reestablish some kind of reintegrated post-Soviet space, he can't tolerate that particular kind of even-handedness. And the result is this constant pressure on Ukraine to make a choice, whereas Ukraine, frankly, would prefer to be in good relations with everybody concerned.
Well, it prompts another question to Ambassador Pfeiffer, if I could, Stephen Pfeiffer. A listener named Mark says, what's the likelihood of Russia intervening militarily, and what would NATO or the U.S. do in response?
Well, I think the likelihood of Russia intervening militarily is pretty low. First of all, that idea would strike, I think, Russians and Ukrainians as just crazy. They don't see their relationship in that way. Second, the Russian military, as we saw in the conflict with Georgia 5 years ago, you know, is actually still has some weaknesses, and you know, could it carry out that kind of major operation? And the third point is, I'm not sure the Russian military would know what to expect. My guess is that if the Russians went into Ukraine in a military way, they might well find that they were opposed by some Ukrainian military units, and that could spin out of control in a way that would be unpredictable for Moscow.
I'm going to read another email here from a listener who says, I am a Ukrainian currently working in Berkeley, just came back here after a week in Ukraine yesterday, left Kiev a day before the new round of violence started. I'd like to express my opinion, commonly shared by many Ukrainians. We all feel that the United States and the European Union could have prevented much of the currently ongoing violence if they were a little more proactive about starting personal sanctions against families of a few hundred at most, a few thousand people who represent the Yanukovych regime, members of the administration, and some of his congressmen. In their majority, these people do what they do only because they all feel that they have safe haven, financially and physically, either in the United States or in Western Europe. Agree with that, Professor Model?
Absolutely. I mean, the United States has been okay. I mean, we've imposed those visa sanctions a few weeks ago, and at least for a start, that was fine. But the Europeans have been dilly-dallying for the last three months. There was no reason whatsoever why they couldn't have imposed sanctions on one or two, some of the most egregious individuals within the regime. For instance, the Minister of Interior, who's been the guy who's been behind all of these beatings, disappearances, and things like that. You have to remember, Yanukovych and his entourage believe the Europeans in general, as well as the Americans, but certainly the Europeans, are wimps. These are individuals who talk a lot but will never do anything. So when the Europeans were insisting for the last 3 months, or saying rather for the last 3 months, that they would consider sanctions only if there is bloodshed, from Yanukovych's point of view, that's almost an invitation to engage in bloodshed. What that means is, well, they're not going to do anything. We can engage in bloodshed. And of course, at that point, they'll be they would be experiencing so much consternation and confusion that they're unlikely to act upon their promises anyway.
We've been talking, by the way, a lot about Russian deaths, and I wanted to bring in a comment from a listener who says, to add to the many Russian deaths in World War II, many were from the siege of Leningrad, which Stalin chose not to relieve because Leningrad had been a source of opposition to him. This was Russian-on-Russian killing, with Germany merely being the weapon. Never imagine Russian leaders are concerned about protecting the Russian people from war deaths. And another listener writes, it's not radical and extremist groups, in the words of the interim prime minister. Ukrainian people both on the west and the east are sick and tired of Yanukovych's mafia. It is definitely Putin's prompt to call it a terrorist group and killing people left and right. Americans and the world community should not be tricked by this labeling. I want to get Terry on here while we have a moment. Terry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that Leningrad comment about, I think something that would inform the East versus West is just noting that Stalin killed a lot more people than the invading armies ever did. So, I'll take my comment off here.
All right, we thank you for that. You want to comment, Professor Plohy?
What is happening, I don't think, is informed much by the events of World War II, but more of the drama of disintegration of the Soviet Union back in 1991. And it was already then, back in 1991, that the Russian vision of the future world order was the Russian control, political, economic, and otherwise, over the Soviet space or post-Soviet space. And Ukraine was back in 91 and continues today to be a crucial country if that kind of a vision would be realized. That explains, from my point of view, the interest and the involvement and the policy and tactics chosen by Kremlin.
Well, quick update here. I'm sorry, Stephen Piper.
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, if you sit back and think, if you have a Ukraine that has a cooperative relationship with NATO but is not in NATO, but has a free trade arrangement with the European Union, is abiding by EU norms, why should that be seen in Moscow as a threat?
Well, the latest is from the AP. Ukraine leader has replaced the head of the army after clashes between the police and protesters that led to the death of 25 people. We will continue, obviously, to monitor what's going on in Ukraine. Our thanks to Ambassador Pfeiffer, to Professors Plati and Motil, who both joined us, and also to Helmut Tram, who joined us earlier from Kiev, and also Roman Shratko, head of Euromaid in San Francisco. Another hour coming up. We're going to talk to New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert in the hour ahead about the sixth extinction. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.